A few facts about Bloom. He is married to Molly, but hasn't slept with her since a month before the birth of their son, Rudy, who died 11 years ago, 11 days after his birth. His daughter, Millie, is about to turn 15, and he mourns for his father, who has committed suicide towards the end of June some years ago. He has a sexual pen pal named Martha Clifford, whom he has never met. He incorrectly suspects Molly of multiple affairs, and correctly suspects that on this very day, June 16th, 1904, Molly is going to sleep with Blazes Boylan. Joyce redefines the traditional concept of hero to emphasize not only pacifism, but commitment to family ties, concern for the human needs of others, sense of self, tolerance, and decency. Joyce thought Jews embodied the aforementioned qualities. He sees in those values an alternative to the bellicosity of Irish patriotism and intolerance of Irish Catholicism. Neither circumcised nor the son of a Jewish mother, Bloom is technically not a Jew, but Joyce understands that Bloom has a Jewish identity because as the son of a Jewish father who emigrated to Ireland, he is regarded as a Jew and outsider by his fellow Dubliners. We realize that he has no choice as to whether he is a Jew or not, because he is always other to the Dubliners with whom he interacts. Bloom is not only what Stephen requires, but what Dublin requires. That Bloom may be the solution to Stephen's problem is suggested by the opening of the episode Calypso with its emphasis upon the nominalistic world of experience. Quote, Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. He liked thick giblet soup, nutty gizzards, a stuffed roast heart, liver slices fried with crust crumbs, fried hen cards rose. Most of all, he liked grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine, unquote. That we are in a radically different world from Stevens is indicated by the syntax with its straightforward, vibrant progression from subject to predicate to object. While Stephen interprets or reads the world in terms of his abstractions, Bloom responds in terms of what he has learned from his experience. Bloom is not interested in theories and abstractions for their own sake. Bloom's imagination and emotional resilience enable him to face the disappointments and frustrations of his life. Yet, as we become aware of his sexual life and Molly's adultery, we understand how partial a loaf Bloom is accepting. Nevertheless, in contrast to Stephen's obsessive preoccupation with the old woman of Ireland, figured in his imagination by the milkwoman whom Stephen imagines with old shrunken paps and wrinkled finger, the midwives on the strand and the old woman of his parable in Aeolus, Bloom, after similarly perceiving an old woman as the personification of his people, rejects the metaphor in favor of enriching personal memories and fantasies. No sooner does reality intrude on his fantasy of reviving the Holy Land, quote, no, no, not like that, and barren land, bare waste, volcanic lake, the Dead Sea, no fish, weedless, sunk deep in the earth, no wind would lift these waves, dead, an old woman's, the gray sunken cunt of the world, unquote. Then he turns to thoughts of the warmth of his sharing his bed with Molly, quote, be near her ample bed-warm flesh. Yes, yes, unquote. What Bloom, this modern Odysseus, must do is cast off his thraldom to Molly as Calypso and by displacing her suitors, restore himself to the position of husband of Penelope. For Bloom, however, Calypso is not so much an external person as a state of mind. The thraldom he must, and indeed does for the most part, overcome is an obsessive preoccupation with three concerns: his personal and racial past, his mortality, and his wife's and 15-year-old's daughter's sexuality. Lotus Eaters, the fifth episode, is the first of the three public episodes, which takes place between breakfast and lunch. As we make our way through Lotus Eaters, Hades, and Aeolus, we realize that most Dubliners seem to have very little work to do. Ironically, Bloom's sexual reveries throughout the day are the lotus leaves which retard his journey. that Joyce calls the technique of lotus eaters, quote, narcissism, unquote, indicates, among other things, that a certain amount of self-love is necessary to survive in the modern city. One has to be on guard against petty swindlers like McCoy, potential adulterers like Blazes, and alert to the small pleasures of a public bath or a covert dalliance by correspondence. Befitting an episode whose technique is narcissism, Bloom thinks rather more of his own interests than he does in Calypso and Hades, the preceding and subsequent episodes. Bloom's pride and rationality enable him to resist the narcotics of sloth, gambling, male camaraderie, and Catholicism. While Stephen's sexual reveries are adolescent, incomplete, narcissistic, and abstract, quote, touch me, soft eyes, soft, soft hand. I am lonely here. Oh, touch me soon, now, unquote. Bloom's memories of passion, drawing upon the first intercourse with Molly on the house, are personal and vibrant, quote, lips kissed, kissing, kissed, full gluey women's lips, unquote. After Stephen's effort to escape the demands and responsibilities of his life by living in literary and personal abstractions, Bloom says yes to life. Thinking of the day Rudy might have been conceived, he thinks, quote, how life begins, unquote. Then reluctantly accepting Millie's adolescence and the potential of her having sexual experience with a young student named Bannon, he thinks, quote, yes, yes, a woman too, life, life, unquote. Are we not to contrast Bloom's worldly acceptance of sexuality and the phases of human life with Stephen's life-denying fixations, which have been shaped by his pride, willed isolation, and his rigid Catholic upbringing? While Bloom accepts his body, takes pleasure in bathing, and is fascinated by the possibility of a woman washing his navel, Stephen is repelled by the idea of someone else giving him a bath. Quote, bath, a most private thing. I wouldn't let my brother, not even my own brother, a most lascivious thing. Green eyes, I see you, unquote. In Hades, the sixth episode, Bloom uses the occasion of Patty Dignam's funeral to come to terms with his own mortality. A crucial issue for a post-Christian world is how one comes to terms with death. In the Hades episode, we see that for Joyce, the stream of consciousness is not merely a technique, but a value that affirms the interior space of the mind in contrast to the external world of the Homeric source. We recall that Odysseus descends into hell in search of Elpenor's ghost after the latter has fallen off a roof in a drunken stupor. That Bloom's descent into hell delves into his memories shows how the modern hero functions in interior psychological space. Haunted by memories of the dead, guilt, morbid associations, and feelings of social alienation from his companions, Bloom's hell is his own consciousness, and the means of extricating himself must also be found there. The emblem of mortality in Hades is the obese gray rat that Bloom sees in the graveyard at the end of the chapter. Quote, an obese gray rat toddled along the side of the crypt, moving the pebbles. An old stager, great-grandfather, he knows the ropes. The gray alive crushed itself in under the plinth, wriggled itself in under it. Good hiding place for treasure, unquote. Death is the antagonist of Hades. Not only does the chapter mention various kinds of death, suicide, drowning, sudden death in one's sleep, infant death, even the death of a bird, but the texture of the language, as in Joyce's The Dead, is imbued with death, quote, dead side of the street this, unquote. Quote, give us a touch, Paldi, I'm dying for it, unquote. In Aeolus, the seventh episode, Joyce uses the perspective of modern journalism to present the moral anatomy of Dublin. He builds on the satire of Dublin life in Lotus Eaters and Hades. In these three chapters, in which Dublin becomes a character in the novel with its own collective personality, the organs, genitals in Lotus Eaters, heart in Hades, lungs in Aeolus, are those necessary for life to continue from moment to moment and from generation to generation. To understand this chapter, it may be helpful to think of Stephen as the protagonist and Ireland as the antagonist. Dublin as a character in the novel is suffering from moral paralysis. Its citizens speak of Ireland in empty and hyperbolic rhetoric, including an oft-invoked supposed parallel between the Irish and the Jews. The episode ends with Stephen using his wittily cynical parable of the plums to debunk pathetically the hyperbolic Irish rhetoric that glibly compares the Irish with the Jews and the Egyptians with the English. Joyce wants us readers to understand that because Stephen's art is progressing here towards the mythic method that is essential to the art of Ulysses, and because he now takes public themes as his subject, he is perceptibly developing into the narrative presence who is telling Ulysses. Moreover, Stephen's parable educates us to read the novel metaphorically. In Stephen's bit of parable, the midwives, his ironic version of the old woman of Ireland, spit plum pits on the barren ground while fascinated with the statue of Lord Nelson. Quote, they put the bag of plums between them and eat the plums out of it, one after another, wiping off with their handkerchief the plum juice that dribbled out of their mouths and spitting the plum stones slowly out between the railings, unquote. What Ireland needs is fertility and renewal. What these women do is spit seeds upon concrete where they cannot grow. Ireland's seers, the heirs to the Pisgah site of paradise, are two self-indulgent old women. That the phallic statue of the adulterous Nelson, Britain's hero, dominates Dublin, emphasizes Ireland's illicit relationship with England. In a sensationalized and corrupt diction, deliberately reminiscent of the excesses of yellow journalism, the final headline in this newspaper episode stresses the lewd implication of the scene. Quote, diminished digits prove too titillating for frisky frumps. Ann Wimbles, Flo Wangles, yet can you blame them? Unquote. Joyce took as one model the Passover Haggadah. The word Haggadah means telling, and the reading of the Haggadah celebrates the continuity of the Jewish experience and the optimism for the future. The technique of the Jewish Haggadah is to focus on the essence of the Jewish experience, the Passover narrative with the stress on the flight from Egypt, while using allusions to place the Passover narrative at the center of concentric circles which evoke the entire Jewish experience, including the diaspora, for which the 40 years in the wilderness can be taken as a prefiguration. Indeed, the Haggadah traditionally has assimilated to its telling new trials, the Holocaust, pogroms, the establishment of the State of Israel, the persecution of the Jews in Russia or in any other place. Joyce draws upon this elastic and protean tradition to imply that Ulysses is to be regarded as the Haggadah of the Irish experience. In the eighth episode, Laestrygonians, Bloom recalls his first intercourse on the Howth with Molly, the very scene she recalls in her final reverie, as she turns her passionate attention to Bloom. Quote, ravished over her I lay, full lips full open, kissed her mouth, yum. Softly she gave me in my mouth the seed cakes warm and chewed. Mawkish pulp her mouth had mumbled sweet sour of her spittle. Joy, I ate it, joy. Young like, her lips that gave me pouting, soft, warm, sticky, gum jelly lips. Flowers her eyes were, take me, willing eyes, pebbles fell, she lay still, a goat, no one, high on Ben House rhododendrons, a nanny goat walking sure-footed, dropping currants, screened under fern she laughed, warm folded, wildly I lay on her, kissed her, eyes, her lips, her stretched neck beating, woman's breast full in her blouse of nun's veiling, fat nipples upright, hot I tongued her, she kissed me, I was kissed, all yielding, she tossed my hair, kissed, she kissed me, unquote. Recalling a moment of shared, passionate intimacy and tender love, the above recollection gives new meaning to a series of thoughts that Bloom has had. For one thing, it is a kind of ironic Arcadia that momentarily pacifies his anxieties about social violence and allays his fixation on Molly's adultery. Moreover, he has associated satisfying his hunger with sexual fulfillment. In Calypso, quote, to smell the gentle smoke of tea, fume of the pan, sizzling butter, be near her ample bed-warm flesh, yes, yes, unquote. Since warmth is something his intimate life still retains, does not the memory of sharing a bed with Molly help him to overcome gloom in Hades? Quote, feel live, warm beings near you. Let them sleep in their maggoty beds, warm, full-blooded life, unquote. In her final reverie, Molly remembers Bloom's calling her, quote, my mountain flower, unquote. Yet Bloom's memory of the goats defecating anticipates the analism of his hallucinations and his practice of licking Molly's behind. And finally, Bloom has trouble sustaining his reverie of better days and poignantly returns to the copulating flies, his metaphors for the copulation of Molly and blazes. Quote, me and me now, stuck, the flies buzzed, unquote. Bloom's imagination and emotional resilience enable him to face the disappointments and frustrations of his life, including Molly's adultery with Blazes Boylan this very day. Joyce contrasts Bloom's characteristic Jewish turn toward tomorrow and acceptance of today, even while being fully conscious of the frustrations and disappointments of the past, with the Irish preoccupation with a romanticized version of the past and the Catholic obsession with dwelling on past sins and measuring every action according to a strict and narrow barometer of sin and grace.